Welcome everyone. Welcome back for those who have been following the Noble Eightfold Path talks. Tonight we have factor number 6, Samavayama or right effort. So similar to the last few nights, we will have the talk for about 1 hour and we will try to finish the the questions within half an hour or so. And that's to allow for our yogis, our retreatants here, who has been meditating a lot, doing a lot of effort. Tonight's right effort. And they've been up since, you know, before 6 o'clock, putting a lot of their time into this retreat. I can see a lot of happy faces. So we want them to continue on. You know, there are just a few more days left. Without further ado, let's put our hands together, our palms together, invite Ajahn for this Dharma talk. Thank you. Okay, clap.
Well, well, that's enough. No, that's the sound of one hand clapping. Now, we're going to talk this evening about right effort and wrong effort, and it's the most important part of the Eightfold Path. It's one which a lot of people get wrong. And I always remember the story of this young boy. And this young boy, he was so lazy that he couldn't get a job. And so his friends, they used their contacts to get him a job in a restaurant serving food. And after half a day, he quit. And they say, "What's wrong? Why have you quit?" And he said, "Oh, it's so much suffering. I give all this food to people and I can't eat it myself. That's a suffering of being a waiter." So they said, "Okay, we'll get you the job of being the cashier. And then you don't have to look at the food, just count the money." And another half a day he quit that job too. "What's wrong? I count all this money and none of it's mine. That's a lot of suffering." So they thought, "What sort of job can we get this guy who's so negative and lazy?" And they finally got him the job as a cemetery attendant. Surely, now it doesn't pay very much, but at least, you know, you don't see money, you don't see food. And after half a day, he had to give that job up. And they said, "Why so much suffering? I spend all day sitting, I see other people lying, and I can't lie down myself." Now that's called lazy. And that's nothing to do with right effort. It's not being lazy. It's something else. But it's also not being a workaholic. So many people, they strive and they strive and they work and they work. And what happens to them? They die just as poor as I am. So what are you doing that for? So sometimes, especially in life, we have to understand exactly what is the right effort. Too much effort and you die young. Too little effort and you are lazy and don't get anywhere in life. So we have to find this right effort, this middle way. And that's a very hard thing to find. Especially, I think I mentioned the story the first night. The right effort to me was explained so perfectly by my master Ajahn Chah. And that was the story of that Australian man from Sydney. I did say this the first night, but I've given so many other talks that I hope you've forgotten it. He came all the way from Sydney to Thailand to try and ask questions of the great master. So he flew to Bangkok and he had to ask, "Where is Ajahn Chah?" because he didn't know. And he had to go to the northeast, which is a 12-hour usually a 12-hour train ride. It's a long way. And when he got to the end of the line, he still had to ask where Ajahn Chah was. You had to get a taxi for, you know, an hour or two. And when he finally got to the monastery where Ajahn Chah was, at least he was lucky the Ajahn Chah was in that day. So he found the way to where Ajahn Chah received guests, which was underneath his hut. And there were hundreds of people there. So many people. He sat on the outside. Half an hour went by, an hour went by, 2 hours went by, and he wasn't even close to asking his questions. So he gave up, disappointed, having come all that way, and in the end not being able to ask his questions. And as he got up and walked to where his taxi would be waiting for him, he realized that he had about half an hour to kill before the taxi would arrive. So he saw some monks sweeping the grounds, and he thought, at least I can make some good karma and sweep the grounds of a holy monastery as well. So remember, if you want to make some good karma, if you want to get your questions answered, pick up a broom and start sweeping. Because he'd only been sweeping about 10 or 15 minutes, and he felt a hand on his shoulder, and he turned round, and at the end of that hand was Ajahn Chah. And Ajahn Chah saw this Westerner. He knew he'd come from such a long way, and he decided to give him some Dharma teaching. And Ajahn Chah didn't have long. He was on his way to another appointment, so he gave a very precise, deep teaching. Through the interpreter, he told this Australian, if you're sweeping, give it everything you've got. And then he left. And this Australian, this is a sort of saying which maybe anyone can give you, but when it comes from a great master like Ajahn Chah, you contemplate it and realize it has a very, very deep meaning. It meant not just when you are sweeping. It means even when you are playing, having fun, give it everything you've got. When you are young, when you go to a party, give it everything you've got, enjoy yourself. When you're resting, give rest everything you've got. A lot of people, when they're resting, they are thinking about what they're going to do tomorrow. They are not resting at all, they're just planning. They don't know how to rest. No wonder people don't sleep well. So if you're resting, give it everything you've got. When you're giving a Dharma talk, give it everything you've got. When you are meditating, give it everything you've got. And when you're working, everything you've got. Whatever you're doing, you put 100% effort into every moment. And that's why I said on the first night, but I told that story at our Katina ceremony, where we always raise funds for our temple. And at the end of that story, I say, well, when you're working, give everything you've got. When you're sleeping, give everything you've got. When you're meditating, give everything you've got. And when you're giving a donation, give it everything you've got. And they didn't appreciate that. But no, all the other stuff, give it everything you've got. It actually works. And giving everything to a task is different from task to task. How you give everything you've got when you're working is very different to giving everything you've got when you're resting. The whole attitude changes. You put full focus on the task so you can rest. And for those of you who don't sleep well at night, there's many ways of doing that. In fact, I think when I'm in Singapore in a few days' time, they choose the titles for my talks, and one of those titles is How to Sleep Well. I thought, what a brilliant title that is, because that will solve so much suffering in people's lives. I know that sometimes they talk about marriage, how to get on in life, the health problems, but go to the core of things. One of the reasons why people are so sick these days is because they don't know how to rest. One of the reasons why marriages break down is because people don't rest, they're grumpy at each other all the time. And it's also the reason for office politics. People don't know how to relax, and so they've lost their resilience, and the slightest thing, which in the old days you just brush off, we explode. As they say, we're on a short fuse. A lot of times because we don't rest enough. So for you who want to rest, number one, when you go to bed at night, do that shopping bag simile, which I said on the first night here. Imagine a bag in your left hand with the past, a bag in your right hand is your future, and deliberately imagine yourself putting them down. So at least you can let go of the past and the future, so you can go into sleep unburdened of all the stuff which has happened to you today, and not at all concerned or worried about all the things you will have to do tomorrow. So it doesn't matter what's happening tomorrow, you can always sleep well at night. And that little exercise is brilliant. The other exercise which I mentioned works is doing the sweeping meditation, relaxing your body little by little. So those are actually ways you put effort into that. You can't just say, yeah, let go of the past, let go of the future. You have to do it carefully. And one of the ways of doing right effort is doing it patiently, not rushing, not taking shortcut. That's the trouble with people in today's world. They want to do it the short way. They take notes and they just write in text message speak rather than writing the whole words down, and people like me can't understand what you're writing about. So what we need to do is to do it carefully and methodically. So when you're doing that exercise of putting down the bags, you really imagine that bag, and as much as you can, over maybe 30 seconds or a minute, you feel its weight. And slowly you imagine yourself lowering it down over maybe another minute. Now that's very hard for people to do things slowly, but the slower you do it, the more the message reinforces into your psychology and it actually works. You rush it, it don't work. You do it slowly and carefully, it does work. So that's one of the reasons why we can do things with right effort. Too often that people rush things. And when you rush things, that's not right effort. You make a sloppy job in the end. So sometimes, learn how to go slowly. There's an old saying, when you really have a lot of work to do, when there's not much time, then you must go slowly. It's a very wonderful saying, because when there isn't much time, that's when we panic and we go so fast that we make mistakes. And when there's not much time, you can't afford to make a mistake. So when there's not much time, we have to go slowly. It also reminds me of this friend who always said that, you know, he would meditate 1 hour every day, except when he was busy. When he was busy, he'd meditate 2 hours a day. That's a very good piece of advice, because when you're busy, you really do need to focus and be able to do things carefully rather than fast. So part of right effort is being careful in what you're doing. And I see that in anything which people do. I was very good at being careful when I was writing. I'd always write neatly. Sometimes I ask you to please, when you write the questions in that box, please don't write in Chinese, because that's what it looks like. For you it's English, but for me it's like, you know, Chinese or Bahasa or something. So please write carefully, out of compassion for the poor old monk who has to read your questions. And whatever you do, if you do it carefully, that is right effort. It takes more attention, more care to write slowly. And it's the same when you are cleaning the toilets. Whatever else you are doing, make sure you do it carefully, slowly, with right effort, so you are meticulous and you make a good job of it. Because the person who cleans the toilets beautifully is the one who gets the nimittas. Just like the toilets shine, so does your mind shine. And if the toilet is left stinky, you know what your nimitta is going to be. Stinky nimitta. And that's so true. There was an old saying in the forest monasteries. This was in Thailand many years ago. You can always tell if it's a good monastery and the monks have got good meditation by the state of the toilets. So the reputation of this monastery depends upon you. Make sure it's clean. And putting in that careful effort, He said it's hard to do things carefully, methodically, and give it 100%, just like Ajahn Chah said, whatever you do, give it 100%. And if you can do that, you find the next job you do, you will also give 100%. And don't think if I give it 100% all the time, the next job I'll be tired, I won't have enough energy. No, this is actually creating energy. And you only have to go to the monastery where I live, because I built most of that monastery with my own hands. I always used to say, because people would actually state that no blood has ever been shed in the promotion of Buddhism throughout the world. That is wrong. I've shed a lot of blood on those buildings, hitting my finger with the hammer, just getting cut with the steel. Much of my blood is on those buildings. My DNA is on there. But you can see I was very careful when I built that monastery. And sometimes I really wondered, how come I can spend so much time on doing all this external work, but when I stop I can get some really nice meditation? That surprised me. I mentioned once already that when I was in Thailand, I was doing a lot of work for all the other monks, doing their visas and other stuff. Same when I first went to Australia. We didn't have any place to stay. So I had to learn how to build to make a place where I could stay and everyone else could stay. And that was really hard work, 7 days a week. And some of the things you had to do in those days. There was no showers, it was just a lake. And having worked all day, you get a bucket from the lake. And that was when the wind came up and you threw it over. My goodness, that was cold. Freezing. But you had to do that because that's all you had. And at night time I slept on a door for the first few weeks. Because that's all we had. There were two doors we had. The other monk who was senior to me got the flat one. I got the one with the ribs on it. But it was fortunate, it was a door with actually a hole in the middle. Some of the doors they put the doorknob in the center. So that was very easy for me because I didn't need to get out of bed to urinate in the morning. But it was so cold and he never slept well. But you worked really hard. And I put so much effort into that building, you can see it there today. And when there was a time to meditate, I had amazing meditation almost immediately. And for years I couldn't understand, why is it that you work really hard on building work as a monk and then you stop and straight away you're not tired, you can get deep meditation. And I realized, because I was practicing what Ajahn Chah taught me. When I was building, I gave it everything I got. And it was that giving everything you've got to the task at hand meant that when I flipped, my job now was meditation, I gave that everything I've got. 100% mindfulness, 100% attention, 100% care, and that's why it was successful. It's the same when I give talks. 100% effort, 100% attention, 100% care, keeping nothing back for later, and that's why it works. So when it gets to your meditation practice, giving it 100%, it's 100% letting go. This is where people get very concerned about what is right effort in meditation. Now I mentioned the right effort in work, 100%, but it's 100% on the task of being still, rather than only 90%. And what that really means, what the Buddha said, is whatever it takes to make sure that good things enter your mind, that they stay in your mind, bad qualities don't come in. If they do come in, you get rid of them, for whatever it takes to create this wholesome, peaceful, happy, energetic mind, whatever it takes. And sometimes people say that all you need to do is be mindful and aware. And they think that is enough right effort in meditation. But it is not. And I like telling the story of the rich lady who came to listen to one of my talks in KL many years ago. She was very wealthy but lived alone. And so when she came to the talk, she told the guard at the gatehouse of her mansion, "Guard, be very careful. There are burglars in KL." "Are there burglars in KL?" "Yes, there are. So be careful. I want you to be mindful so no burglar comes in my mansion." And the guard replied, "Yes, ma'am, I will be mindful." So she came to listen to the talk. She had a wonderful time at the talk, and when she went home, she found the burglars had been into her house. And she scolded the guard, "Guard, I told you to be mindful, the burglars have stolen everything." And the guard said, "Ma'am, I was mindful. I was very mindful. I saw the burglars go in, and I noted burglar going in, burglar going in, burglar going in. I noticed them taking your jewelry out, and I said to myself, jewelry going out, jewelry going out, jewelry going out. I noticed them going back in again. I noticed burglar going back in, burglar going back in, burglar going back in. I saw your safe being taken out, safe going out, safe. I was perfectly mindful. I noted everything." Is that right effort? No. If you see bad qualities coming into your mind, like burglars taking away your peace and happiness, you have to do something, whatever it takes, to get those bad guys out of your mind. So this is what I was telling the meditators this morning. When we're talking about the bad guys and the bad girls getting into your mind, things like sloth and torpor, restlessness, all these desires and ill will, they're the bad guys, they're the robbers who take away your peace and happiness. So what do you do? What is the right effort there? And I told you this morning, if it's most of the right effort is just making peace, being kind, being gentle. That is what gets the robbers out of your mind. If you start fighting the robbers, would you dare to fight one of these burglars in KL? They got knives. They may have guns, and they're certainly bigger than you are. If ever I see a burglar, I would chant. I'd do something. Try to make this. You know what happened once? I was in England. Here's some of more stories. I was in England, and I was walking from where my mother's house was to a Sri Lankan temple. It was about, 3 miles or something. It was a nice exercise. The days when I was allowed to do exercise. These days you just get a car and say, "You must come in the car." You don't allow me exercise these days. But those were the days I was allowed to do exercise. And on the way, I had to pass one of these housing estates for very poor people. No-go areas for the police, where there were gangs with knives and they get into all sorts of violent activity. You may have seen that on the TV programs from places in London. And as I was walking past, there was a gang of young people. They were congregating and they looked at me. And as they saw me, they started chanting, "Buddha, Buddha, 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 Buddha." I was in danger of being beaten up. I don't know why they beat up a monk. I have no money, but they didn't know that. So as I was walking past, even though I've never learned any martial arts, I just... They didn't know I was faking it. So they went back and let me go past. I was really pushing my luck there. But sometimes that when there are dangerous people, I wouldn't like to confront those people. So if there are burglars, the last thing you want to do is to fight. There are other ways of getting rid of the burglars which get into your mind. And this is, instead of using willpower, you use wisdom power. Now that is the most important part of right effort in Buddhism. Not willpower, wisdom power. For example, sometimes people come up to me, especially Malaysian girls who've married an Australian man and moved to Perth. And many times, I remember the first time this Malaysian girl came up to me and she said, I come to your temple every week, it's such great teachings, I love that place. If only my husband could come too, it'd be so good for him, but he doesn't like religion. I've been trying to get him to come to my temple and I just can't. Any advice, Ajahn Brahm? And I said, yes, very easy. It's very easy to get an Australian man interested in Buddhism. I said, all you need to do is buy one of my books. And when you get home, tell your husband, keep your hands off this darling, it's mine. So she did that. A few people have done this. It works every time. She bought one of my books, took it home, and told her Australian husband, keep your hands off this, it's mine, I don't want you to touch it. Leave it alone, okay? It's mine. That is obvious. Australian husbands, probably the same as Malaysian husbands as well. What does she mean, keep my hands off this? I'm not going to do what she says. As soon as she was off shopping somewhere, you know, he got, what is this book anyway? And he opened it, he read it from cover to cover, and now he comes every week. Now that's wisdom power instead of willpower. And a lot of times you will find wisdom power is far more effective than willpower. So those of you who are meditating, who say, I can't meditate, use some wisdom power, not willpower. Now here's another trick for you to be able to watch your breathing, which I haven't told you yet. This actually, I'm not quite sure what teacher said this, or whoever it was a wise teacher, but this was one of my disciples in Perth. He always had difficulty following his breath in the meditation. So one day his teacher said, well look, go and try to follow the breath when you're meditating. Instead of following your breath, he said, just imagine you're following your breath. Close your eyes and just imagine you're watching your breath. And he could do that, just using his imagination. Imagine what it would be like to watch the breath. And then about 2 minutes into this exercise, the teacher said, what are you watching? And he said, the breath. And there was no difference. It was a trick to get you into watching the breath. And it worked. Sometimes you get young children coming to the temple listening to a talk. Malaysian Chinese children are very well behaved. You can bring them any time. But some of these Australian kids, wow, they will not behave. So I have to use wisdom power to try and make them sit still. You know what I usually do? I say, kid, if you can sit still up until I finish counting to 10, I will give you $2. Now, I've got no money, so how can I do this? But I've never had to give $2 to a kid. I sit them down, and I go, 1, 2, and they're quiet. They're looking at $2. 3, 4, 5, they get excited, but they're still only 5 to go, 6, 7, 8, 9. And then I go talking to their mother and father about the Dhamma, and they're and they can't speak. Because if they start, I never said when I would finish counting to 10. I won't finish until Maitreya comes. That's wisdom power. You get amazing what you can do. That's also when I tell people about, but if you buy my book. Because sometimes they say, well, should I buy your book? I said, it's got money back guarantee. You can always ask for your money back. Any book of mine which you buy, you can come up to me. If you don't like it, you can always ask for your money back. 100% guarantee. I don't tell lies. You know, I'm an honest monk. I can't break my precepts. Any book of mine which you buy, you can. If you don't like it, you can always ask for your money back. You won't get your money back. I just say you can ask. You see, that's wisdom power. So with the mind, trying to get it peaceful and calm, wisdom power is what works, not willpower. So So that's why all of these problems you have in meditation, please don't use willpower. That was a problem in the first place. You're tense, you're tired because you've been striving too hard. That works at work. That works when you're building a monastery. That works when I'm giving a talk. But when you meditate and you want to give rest, everything you've got, relaxation, everything you've got, stillness, everything you've got, you have to use wisdom power. And what that means is, when you understand what this meditation really is, it's just keeping everything perfectly still. Have you ever seen movies of, you know, wise monks meditating up in the mountains or in the caves? They are so peaceful, so still. But are they like, what was it, Bruce Willis in Die Hard? Are they tough guys? Are they macho monks? Are they like Arnie Schwarzenegger, the Terminator of defilements? Have you ever seen a monk like that? No. The monks are soft and kind and gentle. Doesn't that tell you something? That's how you get stillness. That is the right effort. When the Buddha, or before the Buddha became enlightened, he spent 6 years putting 100% effort. Even more than Bruce Willis and Arnie Schwarzenegger. And who's these other guys, the tough guys? Sorry? Sylvester Stallone and Ajahn Brahm. No, I'm not a tough guy. More than all these tough guys, the Buddha really pushed for 6 years. And what did he get? Nothing. That was a problem. And that's where he decided to do something else. To go in another direction. He put his bowl in the river Nirmala. And it went against the current. He was saying, if I am to get enlightened, may my bowl go against the current, and it did. But it also told him how to meditate. To go against the current of craving and will. To stop. Just like Angulimala was running after the Buddha. And he said, stop. That is called right effort. Stop. Restrain. Let go. Be kind. That is the most difficult thing for people to do. And when the Buddha tried doing that, his first 5 disciples gave up on him. You're just getting soft. You're sloppy. You're not striving anymore, they said. Because this was another way of striving. The effort to stop. To say no, to renounce, to be peaceful. Now this is the heart of the Eightfold Path. If you get this right, everything becomes clear to you. And there's many examples which I have developed over the years about what I mean by right effort and why it works and how it works in meditation. This does not work if you're building a monastery. It does not work if you're doing a legal case. It certainly doesn't work if you are the striker in a football team. You can't just say stop. Everyone will take the ball and go past you. But this was my famous simile of the donkey and the carrot. If you ever knew your history, in ancient days, people would use donkey carts to pull the cart carrying people or carrying vegetables. You may have even seen donkey carts in India. I saw one when I was on pilgrimages a few years ago. You may even see them in China some years ago, but not anymore because mainland China is now rich. But in the old days, they used to use donkey carts to pull things. And donkeys are so stubborn. That's why sometimes you call your husband as stubborn as a donkey. He just will not give you the credit card. But donkeys, how they manage to get the donkey to pull the cart. You can beat the donkey with a stick, but the donkey won't move. You have to tie the stick to the donkey's neck. So the front of the stick is 2 foot in front of the donkey's head. On the end of the stick, you tie a string. On the end of the string, you put a carrot. But if the donkey, as I said the last time I gave this talk, if your donkey comes from Penang, you have to put a piece of durian on the end of that stick. Because donkeys in Penang, they don't like carrots. They like durian, just like you do. So, you can imagine, there is a piece of durian in front of the Penang donkey. And the Penang donkey, I like durian. The donkey won't move if you hit it, but when it sees durian, yes, I'll go for that. And so the donkey moves towards the durian. And the stick moves, the string moves, and so does the durian. So the durian is always 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. But donkeys, they may be stubborn, they're also stupid. Even though it's always 2 foot in front, the donkey thinks if it keeps on going, one day it will get the durian. That's why it keeps on moving. The same with you, that sometimes we think the perfect relationship, training your wife, the best job, whatever. Sometimes it's just right in front of you. It's almost within reach. Happiness, contentment, fulfillment. And you move towards it, and it moves away from you. Do you recognize that as a story of your life? But that's especially the case with meditation. You strive to watch the breath. You almost get there, almost delightful breath. Some of you get nimitta, as you move towards it, it goes away, unfair. So that's just like the donkey chasing the carrot or the durian. But I've been to Penang many times now. And it's also, my talks go on YouTube, they're on iPods, they're on apps. And so many people have been listening to those talks while driving the donkey carts. The donkey has listened to them as well. And now donkeys in Penang, they know how to catch the durian. So that's why they can't use that method anymore. And how does a donkey catch the durian? A donkey has been walking after that durian, rushing after that durian, running like hell after that durian, and it still can't catch it. But it hears the Buddha's teachings. Stop. Let go. Make peace. Be gentle. And the donkey stops. That's called right effort to stop. And what happens to the durian? It starts moving further away. It's now 3 foot away from the donkey's mouth. 3 foot six, 4 foot away. It's never been as far away before. And then something strange happens. Something which had never occurred before in the donkey's life. The durian starts moving towards the donkey. It's gone up 4 foot and now it starts coming back. And when it's in its usual place of 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth, now it's coming really fast, right towards the donkey. And all the donkey needs to do, does it need to strive, to put forth effort, to struggle, to do anything? No, just stay still. And just at the right moment, you must always remember metta, compassion. At the right moment, the donkey thinks, durian, the door of my mouth is open to you. Come in. And the durian comes right into the donkey's mouth. That is how donkeys catch durians. That is how you develop deep meditation. Now that, you may think it's a funny simile, I've said it many times, but that is 100% accurate of the right effort needed to become enlightened. You go chasing enlightenment, and it's always 2 foot in front of you. You learn how to stop, like the Buddha said to Angulimala, to let go, to renounce, and then you find all the wholesome qualities come to you. That is how it works. Or, one of Ajahn Chah's best similes. I heard this on my first year staying with him at Wat Bapong. This is now 38 years ago. Probably around this time, this month, when I first went there. And he kept on repeating the same simile again and again and again. Just like I do. A chip off the old block of my master. We keep saying it again and again because so you remember it and practice it. And the simile was, he said his monastery was a mango orchard. And as soon as he started saying this, I was wondering what the heck he was talking about. There were no mango trees in that monastery. And he continued that the mango trees have been planted by the Buddha. And that those trees are now all mature, with hundreds of ripe, juicy mangoes on every branch. And he continued by saying, you monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen, are so lucky these days that all those beautiful mango fruits are just there. And you don't need to climb the tree to get a mango. You don't need to take a stick and throw it up to get the mango to fall. You don't even need to shake the mango tree. All you need to do to get a mango to fall is sit under the mango tree and open your hand and a mango will fall. Now that was a brilliant simile from one of the great monks of the last century, Ajahn Chah. At first you thought such teachings were crazy. What has that to do with right effort? In real life, if you want a mango and you sit under a tree with your hand open waiting for it to fall, you'll be there till next Christmas. If the mango does fall, it will fall on your head first before it falls in your hand. That was crazy stuff. But many years later, when I was meditating, all those stories which I dismissed as crazy stuff, you remember. And I thought, my goodness, what a brilliant simile that was of a great master. How true that is. Because every time I shook my mango tree, threw sticks up or tried to climb it and make my mind peaceful, nothing ever fell. I could never get peaceful by trying. But when I just sat under the mango tree of meditation, sat and just opened my heart, the door of my heart is open no matter what happens. Mango after mango fell right into my hand. My goodness, that was someone who understood right effort, the great master Ajahn Chah. So, you and meditation, you who have been struggling and striving and getting nowhere, please understand what's been going on. You've been going in the wrong direction. Sometimes I have to repeat this year after year after year after year, and sometimes somebody eventually stops. Oh, I'm giving up. What's the point? I let go. And when you do, that's when the mangoes fall. It's using wisdom power, not will power, to get your mind to be peaceful and still. And this is not just for those on retreat here, it's for those who are just coming to listen to a talk. Right effort is exactly 100% with whatever you're doing, but what that actually is different from task to task. If, for example, that you're an athlete, or even more accurately, you're one of these gymnasts I remember meeting just one of these top gymnasts who, I know, it's actually this first time I met this, was a top Indian dancer. She was so famous in India that she was on the front cover of glossy magazines. You know, she was basically a celebrity in India when I saw her. And I remember asking her, I said, how can you dance to such a high level that you're, you know, one of the best in this huge country of, you know, millions, hundreds of millions of people? And she said, I train and train and train, but when I perform, that's where the effort stops. When I perform, I totally let go and disappear, and I just let the dance come out. That was the first time I heard this. And since that time, sometimes you meet top musicians, gymnasts, and they all say the same thing. You put the effort in beforehand, train, 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 but when you actually do something, when you perform, you have to disappear. And if you disappear and just let go, just the dance or the routine of the gymnast, it just comes out. And you just sit there watching it happen, not putting any effort in at all, just like being a bystander. And then it is absolutely perfect. The monk sitting next to me will probably know this. Whenever you do chanting as a monk, if ever I try and remember the chant, I always forget it. If ever I just let it flow, it flows easily. Whatever you do in life, when you strive, if I put effort into this talk, I'll make a mess of it. When I just let it flow, it flows easily. Have you ever noticed that in your life? Sometimes I remember even in maths, when I was doing a maths problem, if I just get out of the way, I'd get a brilliant solution. When I tried to get involved and make it happen, I'd always mess up. So much of life is like that. So, a lot of times, what right effort is wisdom power, not willpower. The will disturbs things and makes things go wrong. It stops the natural flow of things. So this is where you understand the power of wisdom, especially in your meditation. To sit there under the mango tree with your hand open and you let it fall. That works in meditation, when you're playing classical music, in gymnastics. But of course it doesn't work when you're cleaning the toilets. You can't sit there and say, oh, may the toilets clean themselves. So this is a problem with people. They think right effort, what you do for one task, is exactly the same you do for the other tasks. That's why even these joke pages of Buddhism, and they have, you know, the old jokes of how many lawyers does it take to change a light bulb. Now there is on the internet, you find how many Ajahn Brahms does it take to change a light bulb. And the answer is none. The light bulb will change by itself. It's on there now. And that's not what we mean. If you change a light bulb, you have to put effort in. It's actually doing something. But when there's many tasks in life, you have to just be patient. Be still and let it happen. So a lot of the effort, in, especially in Buddhism and meditation, is actually to guard things. To make sure that you don't get involved. One of my teachers in the early days, he was from Thailand, and he used to say what made him a great meditator was an experience he had as a young boy. His father gave him some seeds, and he planted those seeds in the garden, and he would water them every day, but because he was very young, he got impatient after 5 or 6 days. He couldn't see anything happening. I've been watering those things for 5 days. Nothing is happening. They must be all dead underneath. And the father had to explain that when a seed is planted, the seed splits and a little shoot comes up, and it takes time to reach the surface. It's probably pushing its way to the top right now, said the father. Carry on watering for a few more days. And he did, and of course his father was right. After another couple of days, he saw tiny shoots just appear above the ground. So being a young boy, he was so excited, he started watering the shoots twice a day. And that didn't matter, the shoots kept on growing, and when they were about 2 inches high, at that point he lost his patience. he decided to stretch them all to make them grow bigger. And when you stretch a plant, he pulled them all out and killed every one of them. You can't stretch plants. Your job of a gardener is to guard the plant, to make sure it's well watered and make sure that nothing eats it. So that's the job of a gardener, and that's the job of right effort in meditation, to guard your mind. Not to make it grow and be peaceful, but to guard it, to make sure that nothing disturbs it. In particular, there are still people making noise in this meditation hall in the afternoon. So now I'm going to, this is mostly for the yogis here. Now I'm going to introduce to you the burglar training. When you come into this room in the mid-afternoon, you have to imagine you're a burglar. And you're a burglar, you're coming into this meditation hall. So when you open the door, if it makes a noise, you're going to be caught and sent to jail. So you have to open the door so carefully and close it so quietly, just like a burglar has to do. And when you walk to your seat, you have to walk like that cat, so no one can hear your footsteps. And when you get to your seat, you've got to sit down like an invisible person, so no one hears you plop onto your seat, or your bags rustle, so no one hears you come. And no one hears you go. You are like burglar man or burglar woman. That's not, I'm not training you for a career after this retreat, by the way. But it's something you can do here. And if burglars can do that, can't you? Are you smarter than a burglar or more stupid than a burglar? So please, get the mind of a burglar when you come into this room. No one hears you come, and no one hears you go. And that way, you can be like that person in Australia. The person in Australia, he went out to the pub at night. He told his wife he'd be back by 11 p.m. You know, one thing happened after another, and 1 p.m. he still hadn't come home yet. So he went to the police station. He went to the police station before going home, and he asked the policeman on the desk, "Are there any burglars here?" He said, "What do you want to see a burglar for?" He said, "I want some tips on how to get into my house without waking my wife." If burglars can do it, can't men do it? So, this is how you can creep into this hall, calm and quiet, without disturbing anybody. That is also a lot of right efforts. It takes a lot of care, a lot of effort, and a lot of sensitivity. So please do that. Now that's actually what right effort means in a form of meditation and a form of Buddhism. It makes you so still and peaceful. And sometimes people think, well, if you don't do anything, you fall asleep. But that doesn't happen either. In a talk coming tomorrow about right mindfulness, I will tell you that when you are still, you get huge amounts of energy. Is Ajahn Brahm an energetic monk? I have huge amounts of energy. Because when you learn how to be peaceful, the energies arise. And arise and arise. It's a source of deep energy when you're very peaceful and still. Ajahn Chah again used to say, to exercise and have a healthy body. So to have a healthy body, you have to exercise it. If you want it to be strong, you must run, lift weights, and do things with the body. That's how to make it strong. But if you want a strong mind, you have to keep it still. That is an amazing saying, because most people think, to have a strong mind, you have to think a lot, exercise, do sudokus, whatever it is, to exercise your brain. But that's not what Ajahn Chah said. That's not what the Buddha said. You keep the mind still, and it gets incredibly strong, and wise, and perceptive, and kind. All come from stillness. from wisdom power. So that actually comes by effort in your life. In all the other things I do in my life, whether it's writing books, whether it's working for the sake of Buddhism, starting Buddhist temples, all that stuff, I put a certain type of effort in. But when it comes to meditation, it's a specific type of effort. The effort to stop, to renounce, to make peace, to be kind, to be gentle, to guard. That is the right effort of meditation, which takes you all the way to Nibbana. Freedom at last. Woohoo! So, that is the talk on right effort this evening. Not as many jokes as you usually get, but we got some questions coming soon, and I'm sure I can put a few jokes in the questions. Thank you for listening. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Now the joke time. Here we go. Oops. They're all in a rubber band. Someone's been messing around. Okay, so not that many questions. Here we come, the first question. Dear Ajahn Brahm, Theravada Buddhism says rebirth takes place immediately. No, it doesn't. You have to die first. Yes. Oh, gee. Rebirth takes place immediately after you die. Mahayana says any time after death, up to 49 days. And Vajrayana Buddhism, the Bardo is an intermediate state. What is your Mahayana view of this? And any sutta to support it in the 49 days of Bardo case during this period, this being is classified under which of the 31 realms or planes of existence? So this is what happens when you die. And the Theravada Buddhism does not say that you get reborn immediately. That was actually one of the Abhidharmas come a long time after the time of the Buddha, the Katawatu. And many of us, we always argue with that. It's inconsistent with everything else the Buddha said. So when you die, you don't immediately get reborn in another plane. No, it takes time. You have time to go and haunt all the people who you don't like. All those bosses from hell. You've got a great opportunity now to get your own back. You don't want to miss that, do you? There was this one Thai lady over in Perth, married to a Chinese man, and she had such a bad relationship with her husband. When she was getting very old and sick, she said, "Now, doctors say I haven't got that long to live. And I really don't trust my husband. I don't trust him to give me a proper funeral." So he said, "I want to do a deal with your Buddhist temple. If you promise to pay for and arrange all the funeral, because I trust you, Ajahn Brahm, then I will leave you half of my house for the Buddhist Society." Now, I can't do deals like that because I'm a monk. So I told my committee, they did know how much it costs, and that was really a good little earner for our Buddhist temple. So they said, "Yes, we'll do that." So we signed the contract, whatever it was, the will. And about a few months later, it didn't take that long, she passed away. And I organized a funeral for her and got our Buddhist temple to pay the bill. And of course, a nice funeral we did for her. And after the funeral was finished, we didn't go up to the widow, the Chinese man called George, and say, "Cough up, George, we need the money." We're not like that. So we just waited. And after about a month or two, we asked George, "Now, have you seen the will?" And he said, "Ajahn Brahm, I've been looking for the will everywhere. I can't find it." Okay, never mind. You know, I'm not a business monk. So after another couple of weeks, I found the will yet. "No, I just don't know where she put it," he kept on saying. And one morning, he came to my temple really early on. He was obviously agitated, and he wanted to speak to me. And I said, "What's up, George?" "Here's the will, Ajahn Brahm." You found it. Yes, yes. Please take it. What happened? In the middle of the night. You guessed it. His wife came. George, George, give the will to those monks. He knew where the will was all the time. He just didn't want to give any money to the temple. He knew where the will was, and he needed his wife's ghost to wake him up in the middle of the night, shouting at him, George, George, get the will. My goodness, was he terrified. He couldn't give you the will fast enough. Thank you, ghost. Otherwise, we'd never get anything for our temple. That's why I like ghosts. They're very helpful. And that's a true story. So, if you die first and your wife doesn't do the will properly, you come and tell her off. So be careful. Just because someone's dead, you can't mess around. They will come back and they will haunt you. So it's great being a ghost. When you're a ghost, what would you like to do? It's really interesting, isn't it? I can go to this person and find out what they're really doing. So it's good fun being a ghost. So you don't die immediately. We do die immediately, but... Yeah. You don't go somewhere else immediately. You hang around for a while to make sure everything's done correctly. So, and 49 days, I don't know where this came from, but that's also in my tradition too. Because this is another true story. There was our treasurer of our monastery in Thailand. His daughter got cancer. And because he was a treasurer, you know, our monastery was his monastery. We knew the daughter, and he always gave us updates. We kept chanting for her, but no, nothing worked. Sometimes the daughter was very young, in her late 20s, and eventually she died. So because they were disciples of our temple in Thailand, I knew exactly when she died, and we did the funeral service for her. So I knew everything about the details. A few weeks later, again, he came early to our monastery. The first taxi he could take in the morning, he came. He came so early, I said, what are you doing here so early for? And he said, something strange happened last night. They were having breakfast. And just like in the old Chinese tradition, everyone would sit around on the floor, a few plates of things. And they were sitting around, a big family, maybe 13 or 14 people. And one of his other daughters just happened to be saying, during breakfast, oh, I had a dream of my sister last night. She came to me and said, it's time for me to go and take leave. And at that, everyone stopped eating. Because everyone in that house, the 13 of them, or maybe I think it was a bit more, maybe 16 of them, they all had exactly the same dream that night. Exactly the same. They all dreamt of their daughter or their sister coming to them in their dream, saying, I've been here long enough, it's time for me to go and come to take leave of you. And that was so spooky that everyone having the same dream, the treasurer, who was the head of the family, the father, got the first taxi and came and spoke to me. He said, what's going on? And I said, she's come to take leave, obviously. And as soon as he left, I got out the calendar to count the days, exactly 49 days since her death, until the time she took leave. And I often quote that anecdote as compelling evidence to say, even in Theravada, 49 days, I don't know why, but that seems to be an average time people hang around to make sure everything is done properly, all the family, are settled, and then they can go on. So that's, a wonderful little story of 49 days. Yes, it can be right. So sometimes they say the Bardo intermediate state, that is also in Theravada. The Antarabhava is there certainly in the Theravada as well. So there's not that much difference between, actually there's no difference between Theravada, Mahayana and Hahayana. It's all the same. So sometimes people can get reborn straight away, Most people stick around for a while, and if you stick around for too long, then you do become hungry ghost. And ghosts, they can stick around for a long time. As the following, this is another true story. This was the story of one of my friends. His name was Jim Hannah. He's a Scotsman. And he had a friend, an English guy. And this story, I have to go back a couple of years, when these two young men migrated from London to Australia, you know, for a new life, new opportunities, and a warmer climate. So they weren't homosexual, they weren't gay, but they shared a house together, you know, when they get started, you know, to share the costs. They all had girlfriends each. And his friend, one of these two men, again got cancer and was dying. And he told his friend who came with him, he said, "When I die, I'm going to stay around and haunt you." And my goodness, he does. He's still there. And, no, just silly things. He was a bit of a joker. You're in the shower, and it goes from hot to cold. He's watching a movie on TV, and the ghost doesn't like that movie, so he turns the channel. This is a separate couple in Perth. They had a ghost in their house. And that's why whenever they're watching something on TV, if the ghost didn't like that movie or that channel, the ghost would actually change the channel. And the owner of the house would get the remote and change it back again. The ghost would change it back again. Always having this terrible little argument about what channel they watch on TV. They solved the problem. This is a true story. They solved the problem by buying another TV. That's for the ghost. This is for us. So the ghost watches what it wants to watch. And the people in the house watch what they want to watch. That's a true story. So it works. Everyone's happy. But this particular ghost was always messing around. And his friend, this guy, could never see the ghost. But no, he said one day the ghost would do amazing things. He came home from work and all the furniture in the lounge room was in the garden outside. The ghost had moved it just for fun. So it was, it's a cheeky ghost. But, the guy got to understand that. It wasn't much of a problem. And this fellow Jim, this is a guy I really know because he was a disciple. He said he was visiting his mate, having a cup of coffee, and they were talking about the ghosts. And Jim said, "I don't believe in ghosts. You're just having me on." And the friend said, "No, he's here. Look, I'll prove it for you. I'll ask the ghost to do something." And what actually happened, there was a pot plant on the coffee table, and a leaf broke off. Which is, not that extraordinary. But then the leaf flew horizontally and then went vertically down and was half on and half off the coffee table on the edge. That was spooky. But Jim said, no, that's just coincidence. It's the wind. Then another leaf broke off, did exactly the same, horizontal and then vertically down and fell exactly on top of the first leaf. "Now this is a trick." And then when the third leaf fell off and flew horizontally and down, that's when Jim never said anything. He just got up off his chair, ran to his car, and didn't stop until he was a long way away from that house. There are such things as ghosts, but a lot of the time they're just playing around. So you have to be very careful. If you don't treat your husband right, he's going to come and play around. If you don't treat your wife right, be careful, for 49 days, you're going to get very worried. So yeah, we do have that. And as for the planes where you get reborn, we actually make new planes every time. Sometimes, this is interesting in Buddhism, I'm serious stuff again now. Sometimes we say there's different places where you can exist. And I was always really wondering, why can there be hell realms in Buddhism? And especially they have this ancient idea that somebody judges you and say, "You go to this hell, you go to that hell, you go to heaven." That never made any sense to me. How can like heavenly beings send someone to those places? If that was me as a heavenly being, I'd say, "Never mind what you did. I forgive you. Adolf Hitler, look, you know, we'll shave off that moustache and give you a new wig so no one knows who you are. We'll send you to heaven anyway. Because you forgive people. You have loving kindness in Buddhism. And so I can't see why anyone would send another person to hell. But I can understand why you will send yourself to hell. Because you will go to heaven or hell. No one sends you up there other than yourself. Because you think that's what you deserve. You think that you've done something bad in this world, or many bad things, and people believe they should be punished, and that's why they send themselves to hell. And please don't do that. Please have forgiveness and compassion. Acknowledge your mistakes, forgive them and learn from them. Let them go. And if you can do that, you never need to go to hell ever again. You send yourself down there and you make the punishments you think are appropriate for you. It's the same in heaven. Heavens are custom made. Because sometimes when I read about heavens in the Buddhist scriptures, all about, you know, are these lute musics and white clothes and ambrosia food. I don't like ambrosia. You know, I'm English, I like fish and chips. So I will suffer in heaven. I didn't like the lute music, I like rock. So if you go to heaven, it depends what you like. And that's what you will get when you go there. You custom make your heaven. So if you are from Penang, in heaven there are so many durian trees. If you come from England, that's stinky, you can keep that heaven. I'm going to another heaven. Heavens are custom made for what you want. You know that story of the three men who went up down to hell? And when they went down to hell, the first guy, they gave him this incredibly ugly woman. And he said, this is your wife for eternity. Because you were unfaithful to your wife up in heaven, we are going to give you the ugliest woman in hell to be your wife as a punishment for you. Because you're a bad person. Is that how this work? I think I'm going to stop this joke before I go too far. Because I think I got it wrong from the beginning. Oh no, that's right, yeah. And the second guy, when he went down to hell, he was also given a very ugly girl. And because you were also cheating on your wife, this has to be your companion for the rest of eternity. And oh God, having to put up with this. And then the third guy got Angelina Jolie. He said, wow, how come I've got Angelina Jolie as my wife for the rest of the eon? He said, because this is Angelina Jolie's punishment for... for cheating on Brad Pitt. He was the ugliest guy in hell. But anyway, I got that joke right at the end. That's a miracle. So anyway, going back to... You make heavens and hells. And that's why the heavens you see, you know, or read about in 2600 years ago, that's how people imagined heaven would be. But these days, heaven is much, much different. So that's actually how we have different heavens. So I better get on to other ones, because I was actually doing good time until I got into all these stories. Dear Ajahn Brahm, last night talk you were saying that human beings are not created but evolve, supporting the law theory of evolution. Are you referring to the Aganya Sutta, the Dika Nikaya? If it is not, which sutta are you referring to? Support this view. Thank you. This is the Ajahn Brahm Sutta. Because it never says much about that in the suttas, about where human beings came from. And what it does say is, were the myths of that time. The Buddha wasn't really concerned with the origins of the universe. In fact, he said that if you start to consider where we come from, that's one of the unexplainables. It goes back so long, you go crazy. What he did say, there were many, many universe cycles. So he did explain in that sense, the origin of the physical universe, like how cars are made, but where do the drivers come from? And these beings who come into the different forms of life, you get reborn into this life, into another form of life, that has been going on a long, long time. So in Buddhism, we do make a big difference between the material world and the realm of the mind. So, you know, where did these beings come from, which came into, you know, the dinosaurs, which came into the animals, which came into the human realm? So these have been going a long, long time, way before, you know, the Big Bang, which started this universe. That's why you're all very old beings. There's not a young person in this room. You've been here a long, long time. So it's actually quite nice to know that. But this is actually where you have in the Western world, they have evolution. They just think that the being is just a body, and they don't realize there's a mind which comes into it. So actually, that if you look at it that way, beings have come from one body to another body. The bodies have evolved over time. But as humans, as the thing which is inside of us, a stream of consciousness, that too goes up and goes down. It evolves and devolves. We get wise, we get compassionate, but sometimes we lose it and we become selfish and cruel. What is the difference between an Arahat, Pacheka Buddha, and a Sammasambuddha? Aren't they all enlightened beings? They are enlightened beings. But the first being who gets enlightened during a Buddha period, in other words, there's no Dhamma being taught, everyone's forgotten what the teachings are, the first person who becomes enlightened is called the Buddha. He's the first of a series. And everyone who becomes enlightened afterwards is called an Arahat. And if it's a Pacheka Buddha, they become enlightened, but they don't teach. They're just silent Buddhas. So, as far as the Buddha and the Arahat are concerned, they've got the same wisdom. No difference. The Buddha is the first. And more interestingly, can a woman become a Buddha? I like controversial questions. And the answer... So we have a vote on it. Who thinks a woman can become a Buddha? Put your hand up. Who thinks a woman can't become a Buddha? Be careful, you'll get in trouble from the girls afterwards. And, of course, you are right. The reason why the Buddha is mostly born a man was because in those societies, there were patriarchal societies, you get more traction for your teachings if you were born a man, especially from a high-class royal family. Basically, you know, it gives you an advantage in teaching. No one would believe in the time of the Buddha if it was a poor person, like a leper or a girl, because they did not have the respect in those days. In some societies in history, they're matriarchal societies where the women are more important and they lead the society. If that was a society, then the Buddha would certainly be reborn as a woman because they would have more traction again. They'd be able to teach and people would listen to them. In these days, in most countries of the world, there's enough equality that it wouldn't really matter. A man or a woman, you still get the same audience and people would respect you the same. So it's just really the practicalities of, you know, getting your message out. During meditation, my mind is calm, but my breath is shallow. And every few minutes, I will need to draw a deep breath. Is my practice correct? Yeah, it's okay. You don't need to draw a deep breath. This is just a little bit of fear coming up. Just let the body breathe. When you're asleep, the body breathes all night and you don't tell it what to do. And you always wake up alive. At least so far you've woken up alive. So you don't need to think that tomorrow's going to be any different. So when you are meditating, just let the body do the breathing and don't get sort of anxious. It's just a bit of anxiety. You think, oh, I'm not breathing enough, so if I better sort of breathe in quickly or else I'll be in trouble. But remember, when your car is in the garage, it doesn't use up petrol. So when you are meditating, it's like the engine is idling. You don't need so much oxygen, so leave it alone. It's just natural. After this retreat, if I have questions on meditation, how can I contact you? You can't. You're on your own. Best of luck. Give me a break. I'm being honest. No, there's thousands of you. There's only one of me. So usually I give all the talks. All the answers are in the books. They're in the CDs. You've heard them before, so just remember what you've been told. You have mentioned that monks are not allowed to sing. In Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh Center, Plum Village, all the monks and nuns sing. What is the difference? They've got good voices, and that's France. So they like singing over there. They may have wine, I don't know. But no, some of those are into singing, the singing monks, but we are the silent ones. And silence is golden. So if you want to hear singing, go and sort of go to a nightclub or something. But if you want to hear silence, come to the temple. Also, his chant is in English, which is easily understood by all. Shouldn't we all follow? Please explain and advise. But he lives in France. He should sing in French. So we do chanting in English. Every morning we do a chant in English. So that's great. The next question is... Here we go. Dear Ajahn, today is the second time that I saw the light. Woohoo! Third time. And who knows, that might be enlightenment. We always do things in threes in Buddhism. So, today's experience was different. My body was moving in a circular motion. The light was shining on top of my head, then left, then came back again. At some point, I was circled in a ball of light, and there was... What? There was... I don't know. There was something either. What I did was just to observe... Oh, it was heat. What I did was just to observe, like, how I would watch a movie. This went on for about 2 hours. I just kept on observing on how can I bring this into a deeper level. Just keep on observing. That's wonderful. Many people here would give an arm and a leg to get a limiter like that. And you've got one, you want more. Oh, don't be so greedy. So now what to do, seriously, is just to make peace. See if you can be more still. You're always having some good experiences. Just be still and make that even more stable. So it doesn't circle, it just stays still. That's all one needs to do. Nurture the plant. Don't do anything. Stop. Make peace. That becomes your right effort. And you know it's right effort because everything gets more deep, more peaceful. Oh my goodness, I'm running out of time. Dear Ajahn Brahm, we are only allowed to ask one question per person. But to be honest, this is my second question. Is this considered breaking the fourth precept? Okay, you can borrow a question from somebody else. And we are encouraged to be kind and compassionate, but when we are, others will tend to take advantage of us. What should we do? Let other people take advantage of you, just like they take advantage of me. That's what you're here for, to take advantage of. Now, if you really get tired, you can always remember that story of the snake. You can always hiss, and then they don't take advantage of you. Dear Ajahn Brahm, hinge drinking Milo, which contains milk, or taking the 3-in-1 coffee tea, breaking the precept. It doesn't matter so much what goes into your mouth, but it certainly matters what comes out of your mouth. That is more important. So talking so much, that is breaking the precepts of noble silence. So you can take Milo if you want, I don't really care. Can children meditate? How to teach them or let them love meditating? Thanks a lot. Yes, some children can meditate. There's whole websites on meditation for children. So yeah, they can. And I know many kids who've been natural meditators, the best of all. This is one of those weird stories. One of my disciples in Perth, she was still in hospital, she'd just given birth to a kid, maybe 1 or 2 days. And she just, you know, she was on her bed, leaning back, you know, propped up, and she just finished breastfeeding her child. And then the child crawled onto her abdomen, crossed its legs in full lotus, put the right hand over the left hand, back straight, and closed its eyes. It really spooked the mother out. He started meditating. He's only been born a few days. So if a baby can meditate, then surely your kids can. But the best way is by example. So if mother meditates a lot, especially when your kid's in the womb, then the baby learns from mother, from their own experience, what meditation is. And it learns it from the time you're in the womb, and then it will be very peaceful. And then sometimes when you're meditating, the kid will just come next to you and meditate. That's the best way, by example. Dear Ajahn, sorry to inform you that there is still one yogi did snore in meditation hall in the afternoon once. Oh, I think he needs some counseling. You are such a great teacher. Seek your forgiveness on behalf of all the yogis' mistakes. The person sits at, and I've got the number. Oh, I won't say who it is. But sorry for so much complaint that disturbs you. So please, if you know who it is, you better leave the hall quickly this evening before I get to you. Otherwise, you'll be in big trouble. So no, we're compassionate. But please, if you lay down, you will go to sleep and you will snore. So please lay down in your room. And if the room is too difficult for you to go to sleep, you can go to sleep in the other dormitory downstairs. That's right, the columbarium. Many people sleep down there, but they don't snore at all. And maybe you can learn from them how to sleep without snoring. Okay, so look, please don't go snoring here. You are disturbing a lot of people. They keep on saying. Next question. Dear Ajahn Brahm, why do I see bright light even when my mind is wandering and not staying in the present? Can we seek your permission duplicating your free distribution CDs so we can share it with others? I'm asking just in case we are breaking the fourth precept. It's okay, the free CDs, you can duplicate them as much as you like, so that's no problem at all. And as far as the bright light, even when your mind is wandering, it means your mind is becoming very powerful. If your mind would stop wandering, that light would stay still and get even more powerful. So just make it even more powerful by being still. Here's the noise. Oops. Ah, it's gone. Thank you. Very good. Here's the noise disturb you or you disturb the noise. Isn't this supposed to be the inside understanding? Why bother with snoring? Signed, the snorer. So please. Some people can do that, some people can't. So there's obviously some people that noise does disturb them. So when you advance in meditation, just like the Buddha was saying, yes, you can do that. But if you're not that advanced, it does disturb you. Okay, here we go. Thank you for saying that doctors should always care, not just cure. In fact, Hippocrates' oath also emphasizes care always, cure sometimes. Oh, really? That's very good. Care always, cure sometimes. But I've seen in medicine, they just spend so much time trying to cure a person. They don't ask whether they want to be cured. And especially when a person is dying, they just don't let them die. It's the last thing they can do is let a person die. They think that's a failure. So it's not a failure. Not caring is a failure, as far as I can see. However, when I try to emphasize compassion and kindness to medical students to motivate them to study, they still try to ask me, what questions will you set for the exam? Doctor, how frequently do you fail students? It seems that passing the examination is more important than knowing how to look after patients. Do you have any tips on getting that compassion, loving kindness from a person? How do you teach them? Thank you, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Isn't it the case these days that the exams is only part of the assessment to pass a person? It's not just exam, it's the practicals as well. And so, I know in my day, exams were everything. And scrawled on the walls of Cambridge University, they had some very smart graffiti. And one of them I always remember was, exams kill by degrees. And it was true, because sometimes the examination, it was all you really tested a person on. And you succeeded because you were good in examinations. You had good examination technique. It didn't mean that you knew your subject. So that's why later on, after my time, when you gave tested to see who deserved to get a degree, who deserved to pass, it wasn't just on one written test. And it was on practical studies as well, and oral examinations to see if a person really understood their subject. And that's a much better way of assessing a person. Because when you're treating a patient, you're not doing an exam, a written exam, you're treating a real person. And I think it's really, really important to have that compassion as well. So I think that's, you know, one of the things I think many modern medical schools, you know, do emphasize compassion and kindness. I think I mentioned this to a person who wanted to be a doctor and didn't think they had enough grades. I certainly know our local university in Perth changed some of their entrance requirements. They decided not just to take, you know, the top flight students, but to take students who may not have got the best grades but were highly motivated, who really wanted to be doctors. And that counted as much, even more, than getting the top grades. So things like compassion and kindness should also be measured somehow or other. Dear Supermonk, that's very nice. My purpose of life is to get married and live in a happy family life. But I'm now more than 30 years old. I am so worried if I could not get a husband to get married. Please help. Thanks. It's amazing what questions they ask a monk, but I'm very used to this. I remember the story of these two ladies in the hairdressers. You know, when you're in your hairdressers getting all made up, you know, you talk to each other. And so one of the women under the sort of the dryer said to the other, said, "You know, I'm getting my hair done really good because today I'm going husband hunting." And the woman sitting next to her said, "Here's my address. This is the name of my husband. Can you please shoot him while you're at it?" That's not what you mean by husband hunting. But yeah, you know, you're looking for a guy. And look, there are many lonely women in their 30s who want a husband. And there are many lonely men in their 30s who want a wife. So you just got to somehow find one another. So basically, internet really works these days. Get on the internet. But be honest. Don't put a picture of you, which is airbrushed, of when you were 22. And I've done marriages for people who've met on the internet. And it seems to actually work, because on the internet you can actually chat to each other and you get to know each other first. And, you know, then actually you feel not so nervous when you're chatting on the internet than when you're chatting face to face. So it gives the opportunity to break the ice and get to know one another. So try internet dating sites. Apparently they work. And if that doesn't work, what I told somebody here, if you're looking for a partner in life, if you look in a nightclub, you don't know what you'll find in a nightclub. There's all sorts of people in there. Or if it's in the office, sometimes there's all sorts of weird people in the office, like your boss and something. But if you go to the BGF, go to a really good temple, there's high quality people there. And at least they've got the stamp of approval. They think like you do. So that's why a lot of people, you know, if they like chess, they go to other people who like chess. If they like Buddhism, they go with other people who like Buddhism. And then you get a partner who likes the same things as you do. And I was saying to somebody in the interview, and actually on the car coming up here, there's one of the funniest stories I've ever heard, and this is absolutely true. Some of the jokes I make up, some are just real life, and you can't beat real life. There was one woman, and you know, her hobby in life, her passion was Walt Disney movies, especially the cartoons. And she loved the cartoons so much that she joined a Walt Disney Society, a society of people who love the cartoons. And she saw one of the men who also loved the cartoons. He loved them so much, this only happens in England, they're eccentric. He changed his name by default to Mr. Mouse, Mickey, first name. You can do that. You know, you can just go to a judge and say, I don't like my old name. I want to be Mr. Mickey Mouse. So she thought that was a good idea. And so she changed her name. Minnie Mouse, yes. And when they met, you know, in the Walt Disney Club somewhere in England, you know, the inevitable happened. It's like karma. It's like fate. They fell in love. And once they fall in love, they decided to get married. They were Christians, so they got married in a Christian church. And you had to feel for the priest who had to say, do you, Mickey Mouse, take thee, Minnie Mouse, to be your loving wife till death you depart? And do you, Minnie Mouse? That poor priest, I don't know how you can say that with a straight face. And that's a true story. But if you're looking for someone, try and find someone, you know, who is like you, as crazy as you are, and then you'll have your happy life together. And see, hear the patter of many tiny feet, little micelets. Thanks, Ajahn Brahm. You're a great teacher. Beside being bubbly and kind like yourself, how can we tell or recognize a monk who is wise and teaches the right stuff? Thanks, Ajahn, in advance. Now, first of all, to make sure they practice what they preach. That's the most important thing with a teacher. So go and check up on them. Just, you know, ask people who have known them for a long time to see, you know, well, they teach meditation. Do they meditate as well? They teach precepts. Do they keep their precepts? So that's actually how you find out. And because you know what happens sometimes? You get a teacher, you have a lot of faith in them, and then you find they're a fake. And that just really is disturbing. So check them out, first of all. Is the Abhidharma the right teaching? Thanks. In the Gurisani Sutta, the Buddha said, the ones who are the experts on the Abhidharma and the Abhivinaya are the forest monks. That's one of the only times Abhidharma is mentioned in the suttas. So what the forest monks, why would they be experts in Abhivinaya and Abhidharma? It really meant that in those times of the Buddha, the Abhivinaya was the, you know, the how to really understand the precepts. Precepts of like restraints and simplicity, which was much more than the 8 precepts or the 10 precepts or 227 precepts. Actually how to keep these and take them even further. And that was the same as the Abhidharma. The Abhidharma was the same as the teachings of meditation, the other teachings of insight, which I teach on this retreat. That was what the Abhidharma was, just the commentaries by, you know, enlightened teachers who would actually explain these things on a deeper level. Only some time later they became organized into these books, and they said it was part of the Buddha's teachings, and it was not. There was the first council when the 500 monks met together to organize and collect all the teachings, and the Abhidharma is not mentioned there at all. In there you can read it, not just in the Pali, but in the Chinese traditions, in all the different types of traditions, the Sanskrit traditions too. It said that Upali recited the Vinaya and Ananda recited the 5 Nikayas. And everybody today knows those 5 Nikayas, the Digha Nikaya, the Majjhima Nikaya, the Sangyutta Nikaya, the Anguttara Nikaya, and the Kudaka Nikaya. The Abhidharma was not mentioned. And just as these days, if I give you a book of Chaucer, a book of Shakespeare, maybe Charles Dickens and Harry Potter, Chaucer, Dickens and Harry Potter, you wouldn't need a university degree to know that Harry Potter was written a long time after Shakespeare. And it's obvious. And it's the same way that any scholar who looks at the language of the Abhidharma knows it was written a long time after the suttas. It's a later work, not the word of the Buddha. I get into big trouble on that because people say, how can you say that, Ajahn Brahm? I can say that because it's the truth. It's got reason behind it. So don't just follow tradition if it doesn't make sense. So I don't mind getting into trouble because I get into trouble in many ways. It's nice being excommunicated because you can only be excommunicated once. Afterwards, you're free. So anyway, look, that's actually the truth. Anybody who has the... And you ask some of the monks, see, I know that, but I'm afraid to say it. So I'm not afraid to say these things. So it is actually, the Abhidhamma is not the teaching of the Buddha. It doesn't mean it's wrong. Some of it's quite helpful, but to Lisa, no, it's not essential. Do we get bad karma by reading Buddhism book while we are lying down on the bed or floor? How about reading it in places like toilets? Just curious. What about paying respects to the triple gem on the bed due to limited space? Is it considered disrespectful? No. That look, sometimes you're going to be in a bed when you die. Sometimes bedridden for weeks. And does that mean you can't sort of read the suttas or meditate when you're on the bed dying? Does that mean you can't read when you've got a bedpan underneath you or you've got a catheter inside of you because you can urinate at any old time? Of course not. The disrespect is just your attitude. So, you know, if you're on the toilet because you've got constipation or you've got diarrhea and you want to read my book, The Art of Disappearing, that's very helpful because it teaches you, especially if you're constipated, how to let go. Okay, so it's not disrespectful. Oh goodness, running out of time again. How does one develop greater compassion and kindness? Why is it that there were times when I feel so happy when I'm helping others, but other times I simply don't feel good when I offer help? Maybe it's because if you want something back when you're offering help, then you don't get any happiness. When you give just for the sake of giving, then that's pure giving, which means you get happy. I always say if you give a donation expecting your name to be on the board, that's not real giving. You don't get happiness that way. But if you give expecting nothing back in return and later on you find, wow, what a beautiful temple. Wow, look at this orphanage. A kid has got a life because of your donation. That's all the happiness you need. So don't advertise it. So you just help because it needs to be done. And that gives you lots and lots of happiness. That's the usual reason. Sometimes I do that when I tell people in Australia, look, as a monk, I'm just happy to give. I don't expect anything back in return. They say, this is wonderful. So I help them. I do the services for them, marry them, go to their house and bless them. And they say, this is wonderful, Buddhism. It's so cheap. So that's not quite what we mean. So with Westerners, you have to say, look, come on. You know, we've got to support the monasteries. Because when you actually say that, I give expecting nothing back in return. But, you know, that still means you have to give donations. Should an incompatible couple get married? If the relationship doesn't work, should I continue to put effort into it or just let it go? All people are incompatible. They're not the same. Women are from Mars. These days they are. Some men are from Venus, they're very calm and beautiful. No, look, sometimes it's interesting, giving a little bit of effort, there will always be a difference between men and women. You will never be the same, and that gives you the strength. What you, one partner lacks, the other person is strong in. What you lack, the other is strong in. So that together makes you even a better relationship. The point is just know how you can accept the other person, accept yourself. There are lots of tricks, but it happens sometimes that you've tried and tried and tried and it doesn't work. And sometimes it comes to that point. You have to say, well, we've tried. It's time to sort of split up and let's try again with somebody else. That's part of our modern life. And if that happens, you tried your very best and it doesn't work out, don't get angry or guilty. It's no one's fault. Sometimes you didn't choose wisely. You know, so next time be a bit more careful. Don't just, you know, marry a woman because she's drop dead gorgeous. You know, her face doesn't last that long. That's why I tell young people these days, choose carefully when you're going to get married. If you are a girl, never marry a rich man. If the boy is rich or he's successful at work, don't marry him, because then he gets so rich he will be able to afford a mistress later on in life. But if you marry a poor boy, you're perfectly safe. You have nothing to worry about. He can't afford a second girlfriend. So if you're a girl, always marry a poor boy. And if you're a boy, never marry a beautiful girl. If you marry a beautiful girl, you'll always be worrying about other people flirting with her or even trying to invite her out. But if you marry an ugly girl, you have again nothing to worry about. She's yours forever. So if you want to have a happy marriage, all you girls marry poor boys, and all you boys marry ugly girls, and then you'll be happy. Whenever I say that, all the ugly girls and poor boys say, yes, yes, yes. So that's my secret for a happy marriage. So whoever you get, you can make it work if you're smart. May you offer useful and practical advice in helping students to develop discipline to endure and persevere in the studies of life. Some of us have weak minds. How do you advise us in developing a strong mind and being disciplined and determined? That idea of discipline, the Chinese art of war, the general had the best discipline. You know, he was asked by the emperor, what's your secret? He said, I only ask my soldiers to do what they want to do. That's why they always follow orders. So if you tell, you know, you parents, if you tell your son and daughter, your children, only to do what they want to do, you'll always have perfect discipline in the house. The point is that before you tell the soldier what to do, you've already motivated them. So they want to get up early. You want to study. You want to be a good person. When it's motivated first, people will always follow your orders. So the trick in being a student is to motivate yourself. So you like studying, you want to study, you want to get up early in the morning, you want to go to classes. And if you've motivated yourself, then discipline comes. The same with my monks in monastery where I live. I don't tell them what to do. I motivate them to see the benefits of getting up early in the morning, the benefits of spending time meditating, until they get so motivated by the promise of the bliss better than sex, you can't stop them meditating. They're up there early in the morning, sort of when they're motivated, this is what happens. So see if you can motivate yourself, and when you motivated yourself, you have a strong mind, because you know what you're doing it, why you're doing it, and you get lots of benefits. Dear Ajahn, bend your faith to fit the facts, don't bend the facts to fit your faith. Please elaborate, that's one of my sayings. You should never bend the facts to fit your faith. In other words, like the Abhidharma, not being taught by the Buddha. The faith says, oh, it was, but the facts say something different. So what should you do? Should you bend the facts, or should you bend the faith? And it's obvious, you have to bend the faith to fit the facts, not the other way around. And there are so many religions who bend the facts to fit the faith. They say this world was created only a few thousand years ago. What about the dinosaurs? They were put there by God just to confuse people. And then, yes, it's a logical argument, sort of it's consistent, but it doesn't make much sense. Or the world was going to end on the 21st of December. You know, amazing how many people believe that. They had faith it was going to happen. But, you know, they totally ignored the facts. So please, you know, bend your faith to fit the facts. Ajahn Brahm, can you share some tips on managing guilt, e.g. guilt on unconsciously killed ants, or even give the best in my past relationship? How can I make up to these beings and people and myself? So if it's ants and you kill one, do some dana for the ants. Get some food and leave it out for an ant. Say, ant, I'm sorry. This is on behalf of your friends and your brother who I killed. Please forgive me. Oh, come on. Don't be silly. Look, you killed an ant. It was a small thing. Just don't do it again. Simple as that. So the trouble is, we always think we need to be punished or we need to do some ceremony before it actually works. So just, if you really, really, really need to actually to do a ceremony. Do a forgiveness ceremony. If you've hurt somebody, it may be, you know, somebody at work, or maybe your past relationship, and that your partner just is suffering because of what you did, and you can't really sort of do much about it. Go in front of a Buddha statue in the main hall anywhere with some candles, flowers and incense or whatever. Bow 3 times and do a forgiveness ceremony. Whatever I've done by body, speech or mind, intentional or unintentional, or things I didn't do which I should have done, to my partner or to aunts or whatever, I sincerely ask forgiveness. And I will try to do much better next time. I will learn from my mistakes and thereby grow into a better person. That's all you need to do. The Buddha said, acknowledging your faults, being forgiven, and trying to do better next time is growth in the Buddha's teachings. So that's all you need to do. So if you want, do a ceremony next door. A few years ago, while I was in Bodh Gaya, I made a vow that I want to be rich, thus I can help the poor. Now, after learning much of Buddhism, I find that is not realistic. What would happen to me if I break this vow? Change your idea of what rich means. Be rich in the Dhamma, rich in compassion, rich in peace, rich beyond your wildest dreams like Ajahn Brahm. Somebody told me today that I was richer than Ananda Krishnan. They said that today, and they were very wise. Why is that? Because Ananda Krishnan really needs to work hard. He has no rest. He has no happiness. I have happiness. I can rest. So that means I must be richer. He still wants more. I want for nothing. So who is the most rich? Are you rich because of how much you have? Or are you poor because of how much you want? So it's nothing to do with how much you have. You're poor when you want more. You're rich when you have everything you want. So if you want to be rich, you made that vow at Bodh Gaya. Now you can fulfill that wish. You can fulfill that vow by learning what real wealth is. That you want for nothing. Whatever you have, you're content with. Your partner, they may not be the best, but they're good enough. Your family, they may not be the best kids at school, but you love them to bits for who they are. And you may not be the best meditator, but you're happy with yourself. Then you find you're rich. At least you're not poor. You don't want for things in life. Then once you understand what richness truly is, then you can help the poor. And the poor include Ananda Krishnan. The poor include Bill Gates, because they still want more. But you have finished with wanting, and then you are rich. So when you understand what richness and poorness is, then you are rich, and you can help the poor. That was profound, wasn't it? Very good. Excellent. That wasn't a joke. Amazing. For this time of night. Dear Ajahn, I was focusing on the breath. Next moment I just went blank. That must mean you're dead. After coming out of it, oh, you got reincarnated. I felt well rested and felt good. It is like sleeping for hours, but that was only 20 minutes. Was it sleep? Could have been, but sometimes it's a state in meditation. It's not really sleep. It's not really being awake. It's just the brain is turned off. It's just resting for a while. But I always say that as long as you feel good afterwards, wonderful. But if you feel really dull afterwards, then it really was asleep. So you were quiet, but next time, be there to enjoy it. Be mindful. The last question of tonight. Dear Ajahn, when I started this retreat, I was very restless and tired. I slept all the time. Today I managed to meditate a few times after getting much rest. Since during meditation it feels too relaxed. I'm wondering whether I've fallen asleep. No, you're supposed to be relaxed. Well done. Get more relaxed. There is nothing I'm thinking about. No light, as you mentioned, just calmness. Wonderful. I did not snore. Are you sure? No, I probably didn't. I was calm. I didn't store, but I just was. This is what meditation is about. If you felt calm, you felt peaceful, you enjoyed it, great. Carry on and see if you can do it again and get a little bit more happiness and joy. It's a start. It's calmness. Well done. For those of you who are sleepy during meditation, there's the old story, which I love telling people, of the Buddha with his attendant, Ananda, and he saw two monks. The first monk he saw was sitting perfectly straight, meditating, a perfect posture. And the Buddha turned to Ananda and said, I'm worried about that monk. And sure enough, that monk soon disrobed and got married. He saw another monk in the middle of the forest who was nodding. He was very sleepy. And he turned to Ananda and smiled and said, I'm not worried about him. In a few weeks, he became enlightened with all the psychic powers. The first monk was a control freak, holding his body straight, but you can't maintain that for too long. You have no happiness, and soon you can't stay as a monk. The other monk, nodding, at least he was letting go. It was only a matter of time, through that letting go, his sleepiness disappeared, and he would get very peaceful and deep in meditation with the psychic powers. So, if you're that first monk, always sitting straight because you're a control freak, I'm worried about you. But if you're, every time you sit, you nod and fall asleep, just hang in there in a couple of weeks' time. You'll be enlightened with all the psychic powers. That gives you a bit of hope. But it's really true as a teacher, the ones who can't stop thinking, the ones who always, they can't even fall asleep. They're the ones who are more difficult, the ones who get into dullness and go to sleep. You are no problem. It's only a matter of time you get very peaceful and get deep meditation. So of all those five hindrances, sloth and torpor is the one you're least worried about. So, talking about sloth and torpor, now is the time to practice sloth and torpor in the right place, not on your cushions, on your beds. That's the sloth and torpor place. So please go to your beds and have a nice sleep. And those who go to sleep first won't hear the people who snore later. So get there quickly. And have a beautiful night. So now we do the sharing of merits before we do the sadhus. Idam enyatina hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam enyatina hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Mayatinang hot sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, very good. Good night, everyone. See you in the morning. Those who are staying, the lucky ones.